The Joyful Friar podcast is made possible by the generous support of our friends. To support the podcast, please visit nathan-castle.com and donate today.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Joyful Friar podcast. I'm Father Nathan Castle, your host, and I'm happy and excited today to have Dr. Lottie Valentine, who is with us today, who's I hope will be a new friend. We have a lot of things in common, and we were just talking about a few of those before beginning this broadcast formally. So I've asked her if she would be kind enough to primarily introduce herself and to share with us what she believes she has to offer us and offer the world at large. So welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's sure. My pleasure. I was born and raised in the country of Sweden, in Scandinavia, and married an American at the age of 21 and moved to the United States. And then I transferred into Boston University and majored in business and computer science, a little bit off track, so which is why I had two near-death experiences later. And then I worked as a programmer and systems analyst for IBM in Westchester County, New York. And then I had my first baby when I was 28 and was on a short leave of absence, then went back to work for a little bit, then had a second baby. And then when I had my third baby, we had now moved to California with my husband's job. That is when I had my first near-death experience. And I was giving birth in Anaheim, which is in the eastern part of Anaheim in California. So all of you that have been to Disneyland, you know where Anaheim is. And it was early in the morning and I'm on the labor table and I'm contracting about 3 minutes apart and a 7.4 earthquake hits.
Oh my.
So here I am on the table and my husband and the nurses and everybody's hanging over me so I won't levitate off the table. And the reason this story is important is because it was one of the moments in my life when I thought I was going to die, which was very different from my first near-death experience when I was completely aware that I was dying.
This was the story that you're telling of the giving birth during an earthquake is your second NDE?
No, this comes before, and this is when the problems begin, which led to my first near-death experience, which also led to my second near-death experience.
Okay.
So, So here I am in this labor unit, and I'm thinking, this is it. We're all going to die, because there were windows from floor to ceiling, and the hospital was a new hospital, so it was rolling from side to side. And I'm lying on this table, and everybody's hanging over me, and I'm thinking, well, either the ceiling tiles are going to crash in on us, or the windows are going to break, and we lost all the power, and we could hear the generators kick in, and the earthquake stopped. But my labor also stopped because it was one of those moments. If you're, you know, in life-threatening situations, your labor is going to stop and you're going to get yourself to safety and then you're going to give birth. So my labor stopped for a while and then it kicked back on and I gave birth to my daughter. I had two boys that were 6 and 3.5. And then we had a second earthquake, a 7.2 earthquake, the follow-up earthquake. Uh-huh. And then I finally got to hold the baby. And as soon as they gave me the baby, I was in extreme pain. So I'm arching backwards and yelling to my husband, please take the baby. And that was the first time I hemorrhaged. Kept me in the hospital an extra day and then sent me on my way and said, oh, everything looks normal now. And then I started having hemorrhaging about 10 days later. So my friends were having a baby shower for me and in the park. And I went to use the restroom and this huge blood clot came out. And I told my friend what had happened, threw my kids in the car, drove back home. And my parents were visiting from Sweden to help with the kids. My husband came home from work. We went to the ER. They do a manual inspection and says, there's not much bleeding happening right now. Could have been a second lining. Sent me on my way. No blood work, no ultrasound, nothing. Next day, same thing happens again in the evening. My husband's on the phone with the hospital. And I'm yelling to him, I'm not going back because they're not going to do anything. They didn't do anything yesterday. So they said, all right, we're setting up an appointment for you to see your doctor Friday morning. Saw the doctor Friday morning, same thing, manual inspection, no blood work, nothing. Sent me on my way. Then that afternoon, same thing happens again, hemorrhage again. We go back to the ER. So now I'm in the ER. So now I've hemorrhaged three times. And I'm lying there on the table. They do a manual inspection again and say, nothing much is happening. So then I finally start bleeding. And this is the divine intervention, because that nurse that came to check on me, I'm lying on this table. I don't have a bell to ring. The door is closed. And divinely guided nurse comes to check on me in the correct split second. So she opens the door, sees that I'm bleeding and how much I have been bleeding. And I can hear the call on the loudspeaker, OBGYN stat to the ER, OBGYN stat to the ER. And she quickly cleans up the mess. And this middle-aged doctor comes running in full speed. And he and his assistant then do another manual inspection. And I hemorrhage another large blood clot. And at that point, I try to sit up and say, tell him that I'm not feeling too good. And he just pushes me down on the table, starts tipping the table backwards. And so my feet are going towards the ceiling. My head is going towards the floor. And the room fills with people. But at this point, I can't keep my eyes open anymore. And I have a nurse on my right coding my blood pressure. And I have a nurse on my left trying to place an IV. But my veins are already collapsing. Uh-huh. So it's very difficult to get that IV in. And as I'm lying on this table, I can hear the nurse on my right is coding my blood pressure. And she yells out, 50 over 15, hurry. And I'm lying on the table thinking, you know, what's taking them so long? And I feel like I jumped out of an airplane, falling to the ground without a parachute, that kind of feeling. And it's probably my blood pressure that's just crashing at that point.
Were they trying to give you blood? Is that what the point was of the IV?
No, they were trying to revive me at this point because they knew I was going into shock. They're probably in trying to get epinephrine or something into my veins. But they couldn't get in because my veins are collapsing because I'm in shock now. So it's very difficult to get that IV in. But it was shortly after that nurse yelled out 50 over 15, hurry, that I knew that I was dying. And that was a very, very different feeling from that fear that I had when giving birth, thinking that this is the day where I'm going to die. I didn't think it was going to end this way. This was a knowing. I knew I was dying at that point. And at that point, I'm lying on this table and I don't believe in God, even though I was confirmed when I was 14. Back then, yeah, I was raised in Sweden. So the church and the state were not separated yet. So if you were born in Sweden, you were automatically a Lutheran. Mm-hmm. So I was confirmed when I was 14. Did not believe in anything. I did not believe in the afterlife. I did not believe in angels. I did not believe in God. I did not believe in religion. As that I just said, it's when you die, it's black. That's it. You're gone. And so here I am on this table, aware that I'm dying. And I said, okay, well, if there is any truth to what they taught me when I was 14 in the spirit world, if there is a God out there, this is my only hope at this point. So I plead with God, please save my life. You know, I have 3 children under the age of 6 and they need a mother. And it was shortly after that, that I was just pulled out of my body. And so I find myself floating above my body. But in this state, the first thing that I become aware of is that I'm still me. I'm still exactly who I am, but I'm outside my body.
Yeah.
So it's like you step out of your car or you step out of your house. You're still you just because you stepped out of the car. You're not different when you're in your car or outside your car. Sure. So it was that feeling of that I was still me. And I was very perplexed. How can I be outside my body and still be me? And so in this state, I was also aware that there was no time and that I had access to all the information, past, present, and future didn't matter in this state or in this dimension.
Was there any break between your cognition of being in the body and being out of the body? Was there any kind of intermediate state or was it a continuous flow?
It was, a continuous flow. It was just, I can't explain how quickly that happens because it's like a split second. You're inside your body and then the next second you're not.
Right.
And it's just like an instantaneous transfer of the spirit or the soul that is just, I wrote about it in my book and I can't, there is like hypersonic speed that it happens too quickly. Right.
Were you frightened?
No, it was just, I was perplexed because how could I be outside my body and still be me?
Okay.
But all, you know, I knew I belonged to the body down there. And then they saved me, right, very quickly. So I went back in my body. And I always joke that I didn't get the full effect. So I didn't change my life course after my first NDE. So I had to have my second NDE. So then they kept me in the hospital an extra day. But that next morning, you know, I'm still perplexed. I'm so scientific. My dad was a physician. My mom was a hospital floor administrator. So I grew up around medicine. And my dad always said, no, 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 there's no afterlife. There's no spirit world. That's all, you know, baloney kind of thing. He was very scientific. Mm-hmm. And so I'm lying in this hospital bed the next day, now trying to figure out what happened. And I'm thinking, well, there must have been some form of hallucination or, you know, oxygen, lack of oxygen. I'm trying to figure out how could this happen, because I didn't have the belief system that there was something beyond my physical existence. Then I hear my sister-in-law in the left corner of my ceiling, and she had passed away 10 days earlier. Oh. And I can hear my sister-in-law, and she says, everything's going to be okay. And I know it's my sister-in-law. And I'm almost scared of my own what's happening, because I'm trying to understand what happened the day before when I was outside my body. How could that be so real? How could that be something that could happen? And now I think I'm hearing my sister-in-law.
And so, you're in your body now, and you're hearing voice from without.
Yes. So then the first thing the doctor said was that he had to give me blood. And as I'm lying on this table in the ER, you know, I'm trying to turn my head to look at him, and he's just yelling at me, don't move. Because he was like, any movement, I guess, could have put me back on the other side. So he said, why don't you want to get blood? And I said, well, it was 1992, and everybody that got blood back then, 6 years later, they would find out they had AIDS, because we had no way of checking it back then. So he said, I'll see what I can do. And then, you know, I was 34. I was very healthy. I just studied nutrition. My diet was perfect. And he said, I'll see what I can do. And they kept measuring my blood for the 2 days. And then he said, okay, you're making blood quickly. You're not going to feel too good for the next couple of months, because you have to make the blood. Mm-hmm. And they sent me home with, you know, medication and supplements and who knows what. Mm-hmm. And it took a long time to get well. So my parents changed their tickets back to Sweden twice. Then my mother-in-law came. I gave birth at the end of June, and I think it was September by the time I could actually sit up. So I just have memories of sleeping under wool blankets in Huntington Beach, because my body was so cold from the lack of blood.
Yeah.
Then we all got sick that Christmas. We went to the clinic. We all had pneumonia, you know, the flu. We all got antibiotics, and the little boys too. And then 8 days later, everybody's well except me. I'm still sick. So I go back to the doctor, and they come in and they say, okay, you're way too sick. You should be well by now. They take my blood and they say, come back in. And they look at me and they say, do you have AIDS or leukemia? You have no immune system. You have to go to the ER. So I told them, well, hopefully it's not AIDS, because we never did the blood transfusion, but this is what happened. And so then I managed to come out of that. And then by the spring, I was bruising and I was getting pneumonia again. So now it's May, 11 months after I gave birth. Mm-hmm. And I bump into the baby's changing table. Something that would give you a bruise the size of a nickel gave me a bruise that spanned the entire hip area, and it was purple and red. Yeah. And so I didn't have enough platelets. And I also have, my immune system was suppressed. So I had a bone marrow suppression, but we didn't know that at the time. And I went to the doctor, and because I was getting pneumonia, and it's May in Huntington Beach, California. Mm-hmm. People typically don't get pneumonia that time of the year unless you have an underlying condition. Sure. So he sees the bruise on my hip and thinks that my husband is abusing us. So he rips the shirt off all my kids. And I said, tell him, this is what happened to me. My dad is a doctor. Obviously, I know something is wrong with my blood. But we were on a wait to get insurance. And that whole year, we didn't have insurance because my husband's company got bought, and then he took another job. He was like a regional manager, and everybody got laid off. So we were on a 3-month wait. Then he got offered a better job, and so he took that job. Then he got offered a better job, so he took that job. So we didn't have insurance that whole year, and we were finally going to get insurance July 1st, and it's like around May 15 now. So I told the doctor, I said, look, it sounds crazy, but I'm better now than I was 6 months ago because I put my kids in the car, drove myself here with my children and came to see you, something I couldn't even do a couple of months ago. So anyway, he sent me on my way with all the antibiotics and everything, and I managed to come out of that. During this time, my soul was always like half in my body and half outside my body. It's like a merging problem. Like I don't know if it was because I was so sick and I had so little blood that I was always at the point of fainting, or if the soul just didn't get back into its slot. You know what I'm saying? Like a puzzle piece that is sticking up in the puzzle and you try to pat it down to make it even with the rest of the puzzle pieces. So about 2 years later, and I had my second near-death experience. And at this point, if I put my knee on the floor to tie my children's shoes, I would get a bruise on my knee. If I hit my finger on the dishes, unloading the dishwasher, my finger would turn blue. I had a stool in the kitchen because I couldn't stand up to cook for my children. I had to sit down. I couldn't go or take my children anywhere or to a playground. It was just very limited. You know, I could put them in the car and drive them to like their class, like my boys were doing martial arts at that time. And just, you know, get them in the car, but I couldn't do any walking or go to a playground because I was too sick. So many times during the night, I would wake up and my head would be pounding. I would take my head off the pillow and feel like my soul is leaving. That was just my daily existence at that point. I also had a lot of the classical after effects of having had a near-death experience. That is on the IONS website. My watches would stop. My television turned on. I was part of several of the IONS electrical interference research that they did research on. So my second ND happened in the middle of the night. I woke up and my head is pounding. I take my head off the pillow. And the same thing as the first time, where one second you're in your body and the next second you're not. It's just a split second. And I always joke that the second experience, and I had such a hard time to call it, is it a near-death experience or is it a spiritually transformative experience? So this was 1994, and it wasn't until I would say 2014 or 2015 that I said, it doesn't matter what you call it, because it's the experience itself that changes you. And whether you call it near death or spiritually transformative experience doesn't matter, because it's what happens to you as a result of that experience and, you know, how it changes your life.
Yeah.
So this second experience,
not just momentarily, just not in the experience while it's happening, but in its after effects.
The after effect
of yourself.
Yeah. Right. It's what happens to you as a result of what happens. It's what happens inside of you as a result of what happens to you, right? Just like if you're familiar with Gabor Maté and his trauma work, you know, it's not the trauma itself. It's what happens to the person as a result of what happens to them that is, you know, the component that stays with them.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing with near-death experiences. It's what happens to you as a result of that experience. There's always typically a traumatic event involved also with the near-death experiences, which leads to certain type of after effects as well, because the body, the nervous system gets traumatized by that experience.
Mm-hmm.
So the second experience happens in the middle of the night. And so here I am again. I feel like my soul is going to leave, but that was my daily experience. And, you know, I'm saying, no, we're not leaving. We're not leaving, you know, holding on to my soul. But then again, the same thing happens when you just, one second I'm there and then next second I'm not. But the second experience was so different, because now it was just the feeling of tumbling through space. Almost like Star Wars is my best description. Like you're on a spaceship flying through space, like tumbling through space. But then I get to this place that I call the mid station, because there was an awareness that I call it the bouncing station because I got sent back. But there was an awareness that there were levels of some sort. It's almost like you go into a skyscraper. You push the button on the 50th floor. You get off on the 50th floor. You see what's there. And you know there's floors above you. You know there's floors below you. but you don't know what's on those floors because you're not on those floors. So it
where was
that,
your body when this experience was happening? Were you at home this time or?
Yeah, is in the middle of the night in my bed. So I'm waking up. Yeah, right. Because I would constantly wake up with my head pounding because I had so little blood. Uh-huh. And, you know, so my head is pounding. I take my head off the pillow. I'm feeling faint. And that was just part of healing that bone marrow suppression. So,
and
you
is
know,
your husband with you in the room?
He's asleep. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He's asleep next to me.
All right.
Yeah.
And aware that you've just left and you're.
Yeah. Exactly. I just like took off. And then I get to this place and I hear the most beautiful music. But this music you cannot make. And I've heard, now I'm finally meeting other people who have heard the music. But the music is more beautiful than any music that you can make here. So I sat at that synthesizer for a week trying to, I mean, we had the synthesizer, but probably over 200 sounds. I couldn't find any sound that sounded as beautiful as the music I heard in this state. So it's the more beautiful, and it's like an angelic choir. And so I'm looking around wondering, you know, I don't have a body. I'm outside my body. And I look to the right and I see a log cabin, and I'm thinking the music is coming from the log cabin. So I look inside, but it's empty. Then I look to the left and I see the mirror image of the log cabin on the right. I look inside, but it's empty. But then I become aware of this light, this very, very bright white light. And my best description would be if you're standing in a cloud or in a fog and somebody's shining a spotlight on it, because the light is sort of everywhere. Like when you're standing in fog, you're surrounded by that fog, but it's a fog that has light. So does that make sense? So it's like you're surrounded by the light. The light is everywhere. But as I'm turning around, I see the source, like the source of the light. But in the light, there is an outline of angels, and the music is coming from the angels.
What did the angels look like?
It was just, I couldn't see the, it was just like an outline, like you draw with a pencil in a cloud, mm-hmm. like the wings and angels. But I didn't believe in angels.
Yeah.
But I'm still seeing angels, right? So it's very confusing for I'm still trying to put the first near-death experience into place that happened 2 years earlier, thinking it's got to be some hallucination, oxygen, lack of oxygen, this can't happen. And here I am, is standing in front of this bright white light, but there is a knowing that the light is the source, that is God, that is who what we come from. We are part of that light. We carry that light within us, and we return to that light when we go back, because it's the divine unconditional love, which is God or source or whatever you want to call it.
Uh-huh.
But then there's two, I call them the spirit guides, and they're, I can hear they're communicating with each other. And the one on my right says to the one that's diagonally to the left in front of me, "What is she doing here? She can't be here. She has to go back." That's why I call it the bouncing station. As if, what is she doing here? She's not supposed to be here. Yeah. Send her back, right? And, but then I say, oh, wait a second. How can this be? How can I be outside my body and still be me? Because I'm still trying to process the first experience.
Yes.
And he said, if I told you, you wouldn't remember, but you will remember this. So there's some form of, but I've heard other people talk about this too. There's some way of controlling what we get to remember. But then it's like all of a sudden I'm standing on the moon looking down on the earth. But around the earth, there is what I called the silvery, glittery fishnet. Because I grew up in the Swedish archipelago on the summers with no electricity and no running water on an island. And I would row the boat for my grandmother when she laid the fishnets in the ocean to catch fish for the family. And when she lifted out those fishnets in the early morning sun, those water droplets on the fishnet would sparkle in the sunlight. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing this and it looks like a fishnet, because a fishnet is diamond shaped, right? It's like a diamond shape. And so to me, it looks like a sparkling fishnet, which now you can just Google, but we didn't have Google in 1994. Now you can just Google grid around the earth and you can see what similar to what I saw. And then the spirit guide on my left says, everything on earth is connected to each other, but everything on earth is connected up to this grid, to that fishnet. And with that information, I got sent back, and that was in 1994. And all of these experiences really have not made sense until, you know, like around 2014, it started making sense. Then 2017, 2018, 2020, right? And now I work with it. And all these years, so it took me 6 years to heal the bone marrow suppression. It took me 12 years to really heal everything. It took me 12 years for my watch to tick 12 months. So I had all the electrical interference of my watches would all die. And after 1 year, the watch ticked for a month. After 2 years, it ticked 2 months. And I had 16 or 17 watches when my daughter was about 3 years old. And sometimes they would start ticking again. And then I could wear it for a couple of days, and then I would put it back in the drawer.
People that go to IONS are familiar with that phenomenon, but a lot of my audience might not be. But it's a very common experience for people that have had a near-death experience that afterwards they seem to upset their computer or their cell phone, printer, that they somehow send. Was that episodic or was it on a really regular basis that you?
It was a completely regular basis. So I put the watch on when I started sitting up right in September. So this is September 1992, to see, you know, what time it is, because we didn't have cell phones back then. Or if we did, I didn't have one, right? It was before everybody had cell phones. And my watch died. And I was so sad because I didn't have a way of telling time now. And it took me a good 6 months. It was in the spring, like 9 months after my daughter was about 9 months, when I had the strength to go to a Target. Target has the watches right inside. Okay. For those on the East Coast, it's kind of like a Caldor. And I got a watch. And I brought it home. I wore it for about 5 days and it stopped. Oh, I was so sad because I had to, it was so much work for me to do an excursion like that. Brought the watch back. The ladies at the counter say, "We haven't gotten any other watches back, you know, but go ahead, pick out a new watch." Picked out the same watch, wore it for 5 days. It stopped. I couldn't believe it. So I brought the watch. And I'm still thinking it's a quality control issue. I was a management major. Yeah. They have problems with operations management. It's a quality control issue. So I bring the watch back. And this time I say, all right, I'm going to pick a different brand this time, because obviously it's a quality control issue. So I pick a different brand, wear it for about 5 days, and it stops. And then my friend looks at me and she says, you know, it's not the watches, it's you that's having an issue. Yeah. And then when my daughter was about 11 months, as to say, at the same time as I had the big bruise and the bone marrow suppression was going into full swing, and I walk by the television and the television turns on, and yeah, I look on the coffee table and the clicker for the TV is there. My boys, my daughter is with me, but she's only 11 months, and my boys are now almost 7 and 4 and a half, and they're playing right outside in this little courtyard with the neighbor kids. And I'm thinking, well, somebody probably has the same television I do. They were turning on their television. The clicker went out their window, in through my window, hit my television and turned it on. I went to all the neighbors that lived next to me and said, "Are you watching TV?" Nobody was watching TV, or they were at work. They just weren't home. So I come back inside, walk by the television, turns back on. So at that point, you know, I was like, okay, the watches, the television. And then there were problems with the VCR. If I try to turn on the VCR to have my boys watch a videotape, this is back in the VCR days, yeah, when sure, we had Blockbuster, right? Yeah, yeah. And it would not work. But so I would have to stand over in the, almost in the kitchen, and then tell my son, "No, not that button, the button with the little triangle on the top. Yeah, that one, push that." And so he learned how to maneuver the VCR, because if I did it, then sometimes it just wouldn't work. So there was all these electrical interference. The vacuum cleaner turned on. That was when my daughter was about 15 months. And I was helping my almost 5-year-old with a jacket with his zipper. And the vacuum was plugged in on the other side of the room. And all of a sudden, it just started. And it was a brand new vacuum cleaner. And so my son just looked at me and said, "Mom, the vacuum cleaner just turned on." And I said, "Yep. I noticed. It must be some kind of electrical shortage or something." But so it was just this, you know, constant electrical interference. But now, you know, if you go to IONS, you can see all the psychological and physiological after effects that happened
Well, and you're a scientist, and I'm wondering, during those years, had you ever met anybody else that had this phenomenon after an NDE, or did that come later?
Now, they didn't know what NDEs were, didn't believe in the afterlife, did not believe in the spirit world. And it was my mother-in-law that when she came to stay with us, towards the end of August, and she said, "Yeah, what happened? What happened in the ER?" Because she could tell too, and my husband has probably told her. And I told her what happened, and she said, "What you had is called a near-death experience." And so she went out and she bought the book Life After Life by Raymond Moody,
Yes.
right? And tried to help me. And she was literally my earth, I call her my earthly spiritual guide, because she was the one who helped me develop spiritually and start understanding, no, this was a spiritual experience that happened to you. And this is, you have to look at all these different books now and help me along the way.
Had you been had you paid attention to quantum physics and the shift in physics to the fact that we're all energy to begin with, that at the lowest
I
level?
did at the time. I didn't know anything about it,
Yeah.
nothing. And so, but it led me down that path, during the next 12 years. So, during the next 12 years, it took me 12 years for my watches to tick 12 months, right? And after 12 years, my watch ticked 12 months almost to the day. And so, for every year, it ticked about the same amount of months as I was out of my NDEs. And at that point, I mean, I had all these experiences where, so after 1 year, I started hearing the spirit world right away. And then my uncle passed away. And that was a year, it was about 15 or 16 months after my first NDE. And in the middle of the night, I wake up and I know it's my uncle at the kind of in the ceiling above the bed, above the foot of the bed, but in the ceiling. And he says that he's been passing on, he's just coming to say goodbye and checking in. And so I expected my mom to call me the next day from Sweden because it was her brother that had passed away. Nobody called me. And I said, wow, this is so strange. And I waited another day. Now it's Tuesday because it was the night Sunday to Monday. And Tuesday, nobody calls. And I said, wow, this is so strange. I know that he was here. Wednesday, my mom finally calls. And she says, how are the kids? How are you? Blah, blah, blah. And she said, I have something sad to share with you. And I said, yeah, I know. Your brother passed away 3 days ago. And it was just dead silence on the other side. And she said, how did you know? And I said, he was here. He came to say goodbye. And my mother's response to that was, oh, you're just like your grandmother, her mom.
Okay.
Yeah. So there was something there. And I remember my grandmother when I was little, and she was so upset. This bird had flown into her window at 2 o'clock in the morning. And we were on the island again. So it's not even a payphone. And she said, I know it's this person. This person has died, and we have to go to the other island so I can call the city. So we go in this little rowboat to this other island that had a payphone. And sure enough, this person had passed away. So I know that my grandmother had these abilities. I'm sure my grandmother had several near-death experiences because she had so many surgeries and so many things wrong with her stomach and intestines that they were writing her up in the medical textbooks. And they didn't know how she could still be alive towards the end because there were so many pieces missing.
Did you
And
ever
so I'm
ask
sh
yourself the question, was your grandmother's phenomenon a result of a near-death experience, or did it precede those?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. So my grandmother passed away when I was 21. She was in her 70s then. I'm the baby of the family, so everybody's a lot older. Yeah, so I don't know. I just know that she was spiritual, but also I know that I had many of my abilities that I have now were there as a child, but I didn't understand them.
I see.
And I could see the aura around the flowers on the kitchen table. And I write about this in my book, and I would tell my best friend who was in a similar age, and I said, can you see the field around the flowers? There's a field around the flowers. And she looks at it and she says, no, what are you talking about? There's no field around the flowers. And the funny part is that today she's a medium as well, and she's a nurse. So, it doesn't have to happen in childhood. It can happen at any point in time.
Right.
But it was a lot of things like that were there. Or I would tell my brother, there is a because I grew up on an island in the summer with no electricity, so we always had to have candles for lighting in the evening. And we were sitting on my in my grandmother's house, and the adults were talking, and my older brothers, he was 5 years older than I was. I would look in the candle and I would say, "There's a man in the candle." And he would look in the candle and he says, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "There's a man in the candle and he belongs to grandma." But now thinking back at these events, I understand it was probably my grandfather, because my grandmother's husband passed away when I was three, and I was probably six or seven at this point. Right. And so there were lots of little things like that, seeing the aura around my dad, and things that were present as a child. But then I became a teenager, and then that was the end of that, because I wanting to fit in and having your friends tell you that there is no field around the flowers.
Yes.
And then, you know, knowing that I really incarnated to be a healer and help other people in this life. But here I was going down the management and the computer science track, because of the difficulty with the English as a second language. Because when I came to the United States, I walked around with a dictionary every day trying to understand what people were saying.
I wondered about that when we were first starting the conversation, when you acquired English. It was as a young adult.
Right. So we learned textbook English in school, started in fourth grade, but that doesn't really, it prepares you for asking for the price in a store, ordering at a restaurant, you know, small conversations, but not to study in a foreign language. So, I mean, I used to write down my homework assignment in phonetics, what I heard the teacher say. And then I would go home and ask my husband, and he would look at me and he says, "Yeah, what is it that you don't understand about your homework assignment?" And I would say, "I don't know the words that I'm saying because I wrote down the homework assignment phonetically." So that was a lot of, you know, expanding my vocabulary to be able to study. And I was afraid of studying the sciences because I figured that would be a lot harder. So
Well,
then after
when
my
you look back on your family life, I'm listening through the lens of my own experience, which people regularly do. My grandmother lived next door and was a mystic. And then both of my sisters have gifts that are somewhat similar to my own. And you wonder, you know, does everybody have this? It's just, you know, it's more pronounced in some, you know, like athletic ability or musical talent or acquisition of language, that these things, you know, seem to be in greater or lesser degrees in different people. How have you thought about that? About, was I this all along? Did my near-death experiences bring these things out more? How do you make sense of it?
Yeah, I would say it's sort of, I mean, the way I look at it, it activated my life path.
Activate.
Right? It activated my life path. I know I'm here as a healer. It's everywhere. It's in my astrological chart and my numerology chart. I know I'm here as a healer. I always wanted to be a doctor since as long as I can remember, like 3 years old. And I grew up, I was born 58. So I grew up in the 1960s. And my dad would always say, "You don't want to go to medical school. It takes a long time. You know, you want to get married and have kids. You should just be a nurse." Like all the women were being nurses then.
Sure, yeah.
And I said, "No, I don't want to be a nurse. If I'm, you know, I want to be a doctor like you." And then I married an American. And then I, you know, moved to the United States. And again, I thought, you know, should I, you know, become a nurse? Maybe dad was right. But then ended up in management and computer science and went that route. But I feel like the near-death experience is what sort of a course correction of, no, you came here to be a healer. This is what you're here to do. This is your work here. But, you know, it's a spiritual component now, because the way I work is always work with spirit now, because it's part of my life. So
and you became a naturopath, didn't you? Did you
right.
choose
So
that because there might be more openness to spirit components and healing there than there might have been in conventional medicine?
Right. So during, yes, in a way. So during those 12 years, the first 12 years, so from 1992 to 2004, I had all these experiences, first the electrical sensitivity, and then the spirit world visiting me, starting to hear the spirit world. I would see things before they happened. I woke up one morning and said, "There is a black streak on the car, on the van door. You two kids are in the car." And on the third image, I'm leaving a note on the windshield of a black sedan car. And I told my kids, "We're obviously getting hit from the right-hand side. And we went through all the intersections where this could happen. And we knew that was only one intersection in the city of San Francisco because my kids were going to school in the city. And I drove them to the city every day. You get off the Bay Bridge, you come down to the streetlight, and we had to turn left. That was the only intersection where we would have oncoming traffic where we could possibly be hit on the right-hand side of the car. So for 10 days, my kids are, you know, pressed their noses up against the window saying, "Mom, the coast is clear." Wow. And then we come out of, 10 days later, we come out of a bookstore in Walnut Creek, which is East Bay, San Francisco. Yeah. And I'm trying to squeeze my car onto this very narrow street. And there's a big truck in the way and cars are coming into the car parking lot. And as I'm making a right-hand turn, the right-hand side of my car scrapes the parked car in the last car in the row, which is a black sedan car. So I get out of the car. I look on the scrape, the black streak on the van door. And I just throw my arms up in the air laughing because finally it was over. And everybody's just staring at me because I'm sure they thought I was crazy. And then, of course, here I am leaving a note on the windshield of the black sedan car, right? So a lot of things like this happened over the period of 12 years. And the reason I went to medical school was because I went to my kids were not teenagers in 2004. Mm-hmm. And I was looking on the computer. I said, I can't go back to programming because I've had all these spiritual experiences. It's taken me 12 years to trust in the spirit world.
Well, and sitting in front of a computer, you could burn it up or make right? it go on and off.
Because I'm so, you know, so scientific, and I needed so much proof in order to trust in the spirit world. And so after 12 years, I'm fine. And now I'm trusting because everything I have heard or seen for 12 years has been true. And I've been writing things down or telling my kids and things just, it all plays out. So I'm on my computer looking for something to go back to work, but working in the healing profession. And I come across this website, which says naturopathic medicine. And then I realize it's a medical school, a real medical school. It wasn't just some online certificate studying. Uh-huh. And I close my computer and I say, I can't do that. I'm in my 40s already. So as I'm walking to the kitchen, the spirit world drops in on me and says, you have to become a naturopathic doctor. You have to combine East and West, which I took as old and new. And naturopathic medicine kind of is that because we learn the regular things, pharmaceutical medicine, but we also learn botanical medicine, homeopathy, acupuncture, nutrition, more holistic approach. And you're here to bring messages and healing to the people. And you're to write two books, no wait, three. And that's the way that message came through. And within 2 weeks, I was enrolled in the prereqs at the local community college.
Were you still in Northern California at that time?
Yeah, Northern California.
Were you living mm-hmm. in Walnut Creek?
I was living in Concord, okay. which is right next to Walnut Creek. And I went to Diablo Valley College, for those that are familiar with
my first 4 years of priesthood were in Benicia.
Okay, yeah. Right, you're right next door.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was there for 12 years. Mm-hmm. And so that message of you're to write two books, no wait, three. I've gotten that message four times from four professional mediums. And it's always the same. They say, I have your mother with me. And then they say, oh, you're writing a book. Oh, and your mother says you are to write two books. No, wait, three. And it's always the exact same wording that the original message I got. And I mean, at that point, I said, what do you mean I'm supposed to write a book about what? I'm not a writer. I've never thought of myself as a writer. What do you mean about bringing messages and healing to the people? Like, what does that mean? And the spirit world is just focused on getting your degree. And so I literally was enrolled in within 2 weeks and I was already in class and I couldn't even take the freshman biology. I had to start with advanced placement high school biology because I was in business undergrad and I went to high school in Europe, which is very different. So it was, you know, I did all of that and then was accepted into medical school in 2012 at the age of 54 and then graduated 2016. Yeah. So a crazy journey, but the way for 12 years I was getting all these messages and I have so many stories, but I know we don't have all day, but there's so many stories.
You entitled that first book Med School After Menopause, didn't you?
Right. So yeah, Med School After Menopause, The Journey of My Soul. And it was given to me by the spirit world to help other people out there, especially women who think that their life is over when you hit menopause, because I can assure you it's absolutely not. Yeah. And this literally when my life journey sort of got on track is at that time. And it's never too late. It's never ever too late to change your life and to go after what you truly want to do or why you're truly here. Sometimes that mission of life doesn't come into play until later in life, because as I call it, you have to go through life and pick your berries, you know, all the different experiences that you need along the way to then do the work that you came to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, people find that when they're in their 20s or maybe teenagers. And sometimes I feel there's a journey before that we have to do, or maybe there's and different paths.
When you've spoken of messages of different kinds that says you must write, that's imperative in the language. You have to do this as though you're compelled or forced. Did you always feel free to say yes or no?
Oh, when they say you are to write 2 books, no way, 3?
Or yes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know I'm writing 2 more books. It's just, I just know that.
All right. But did you feel free to say, thank you for your input, I'll consider it? Or
I think it was just more, I understand. Because at that point, I had gotten so many messages for 12 years that were always true.
Right.
They were always, you know, our life here is so magical. And so we are so connected. We're so connected to each other. We're all one in the end. We're all connected. Like the spirit guides told me, everything on earth is connected. It's true. We know that through quantum physics now, because the people that got the Nobel Prize in physics 2023 showed the entanglement of two atoms.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. And it's reminding me, because I'm a priest and I've been a lifelong Christian, of the angelic visitation to young Mary. You know, sometimes people think of that story as an imperative where God sends a messenger and says, this is what you must do, Missy, as though she's a puppet. She has no agency. She's just given orders. And when I preached that story, I said, you remember, God hasn't created a puppet show. We're, we're always free to do as we please, even if we have some very strong urging. Did you feel that that was the case for you, or did you just accept
yes.
it?
There is no, there is no, I still have my free will. I rule over my life. It's my choice what I do with my life. And if I choose to do that, but I do understand that I'm to write more books and I want to write more books.
Yeah.
I just never thought of myself as a writer, but I'm already, like, the second book is already brewing in my head and what that is about, because I also have, you know, I want to help people find a way to healing, right? So I have my own podcast called Dr. Lottie Science with Soul, where I bring people on my podcast that can create healing in other people's lives, whether it's spiritual, emotional, or physical. So I interview, you know, shamans, famous mediums. I interview surgeons, physicians, counselors, acupuncturists, anybody who have information that can help somebody heal. But it's the people that I typically bring on my podcast are giving information to people, because there's so many people that fall through the cracks in the medical system because we don't have tests for everything. And so I try to bring these people on to educate the people, so that people who are listening can say, wow, now I understand that's what I have. But somebody who goes to a general practitioner, they might not be aware of that, because it's kind of like a specialized
and education. You were going through all that bodily trauma without health insurance. I know
that
a lot about people falling through the cracks, because I've been in pastoral ministry most of my adult life. And even for people who do have insurance, many times, for example, if they have mental health issues, their HMO might tell them you get 6 50-minute group sessions.
And
it's up to you to heal during those 50 minutes.
Yes.
And if you don't, too bad, because that's all we're paying for. I had only some basic psychology in my training, but I had to learn how to be a pastoral counselor, because there's a need. And there are a lot of people that That's they could afford me because it didn't charge anything. That's
Yes, exactly. I mean, it is, you understand exactly. You understand how crazy it is. The medical system and, you know, our insurance does not cover for a lot of things that people need help with. And they also many times have, you know, something that falls through the cracks, and now the insurance is not going to cover it because now that's not considered standard treatment and it's not covered. Or they're just not good tests. They do the ultrasound, the MRI, the blood work, and then they're told, we can't find anything wrong with you. It's just all in your head, and send them to a psychiatrist instead. Meanwhile, the person needs surgery, but they just don't know how to find the right doctor,
Let me ask
that can
you,
treat it.
do you feel healthy and energetic after such a long history of infirmity of one kind or another? Because
I would
what you're
say.
talking about doing sounds like it will take a lot of vigor and energy to bring about.
Right. Yeah. So it took me 12 years to really come back 100% to be able to move my life forward. You know, after 6 years, I said, all right, well, maybe this is my new normal. And then it took another 6 years to really get all the strength back and become normal and just even pursue things. Yes, a long journey, but you know, that's also now why I do what I do. So I do a lot of, I work a lot with ancestral healing, which is a form, it's actually a form of counseling. So I studied ancestral healing, and there are certain patterns that we inherit, but we also know that we inherit trauma on the DNA. So your ancestors that lived through World War II and all of that, they flipped their, you know, their genes through epigenetics. And we know that now we have genes identified, like FKBP5 is one gene, but they've identified more genes. And that can then show up, you know, down the line. So now your grandchildren, you know, you're the war survivor, but your grandchildren has anxiety or panic attacks when they hear sirens because grandpa flipped his gene markers for the sirens, because every time he heard the sirens, he thought, this is the day I die. And so it goes back down the line. So, you know, if you have a granddaughter and grandpa was in the war and she has panic attacks or anxiety every time she hears sirens, but she hasn't had an event in her life where she was traumatized or she was in a car accident and she heard the sirens, right? So it doesn't make sense that this is now showing up. But so those things can be ancestral trauma and is passed down, via the genes, but also through quantum physics, right? But we are all entangled through quantum physics with each other. Everything is connected to everything else, and so I do a lot of sessions about that, as well as medical intuitive. And with the medical intuitive, I work with the spirit world, and so many times.
Before you move there, I want to make a comment about what you were just talking about, because part of my audience speaks Catholic language. What you were the ancestral healing, and what was another phrase you used to describe it besides ancestral healing?
Ancestral healing, well, it's a form of counseling, ancestral healing. It's actually something I trained in, but the way I work with it is probably slightly different. So
Sometimes
it's a
in Catholic circles,
entangled.
it's called family tree healing, but it's the same
Yes,
idea. It's moving
similar.
up the line, and what you were just describing that we can inherit.
And so we actually inherit trauma on the DNA, and there are patterns that repeat within families. So you can see that in like the family tree, right? But it's typically it's often things that weren't resolved, right? So the things that get passed down are the unresolved trauma of the ancestors. And so when you were little and it's Christmas, and then you say, you know, why don't we talk about Uncle Billy? And your mom turns to you and says, shh, we don't talk about Uncle Billy. You know, something went down with Uncle Billy, but you don't know what it is because you're just a child. But those things that get sort of swept under the carpet, those are often things that get repeated somehow within the family system. So within that family tree. And so I work a lot with that and help people resolve that.
Is that through talk therapy most of the time or some other way?
Yeah, it's through Zoom.
But
I work on Zoom,
talk
with those
therapy
people.
sessions via Zoom.
But I feel it's interesting because I think sometimes we don't see the patterns within our own families, because I often get physicians and psychotherapists, counselors, as my own clients, right? And when I bring light to it, and I say, you know what, here's the pattern, what you're experiencing, and you get that blank stare back, and they say, wow, I can't believe I couldn't see that. I do this for people all day long, but I couldn't see it for myself.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we're sort of, I don't know, we're the it's sort of hidden because we're emotionally entangled with all those emotions of what happened.
And we can
So
be
it's
helping
interesting.
other people and looking outward and not inward. We're in about the last 5 minutes. So I want to alert you to, if there's a message that you want to give that you haven't given already, do so. But I have this question. Of these books that aren't yet written, what do you think is up next?
For my book?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, it has to do with healing because it's my work. I know I'm here to help people heal. So it's you know, the physical, emotional, and spiritual components of healing and helping people create healing for themselves, because we're all connected. And the way I look at my work is, for every person I can help heal, we make a better world, because we're all connected to each other.
Right.
And sometimes we can't heal the whole world at the same time. But if I can heal that one person I'm working with, it creates healing for them. It creates healing for their family. And I've had clients tell me that, you know, my brother is now in counseling because all I did was I worked with you on an ancestral healing session. But he said, I know you changed. I don't know what you're doing, but I'm going to go to counseling now because I can see your healing. Right. And she said, I didn't even tell him, but he could feel it, because when we heal, you know, our frequency, our vibrations that we send out are different, because now we have more compassion for ourselves because we're created healing for something. And then that now rubs off on other people because we are, you know, entrained and synchronized with other people.
Sure. It's a pebble in a pond.
Yeah.
You do your part, and then it radiates outward, and you're not in charge of all the different consequences. You just do your part.
Exactly. Everybody does their part. Everybody creates healing for themselves. Because it's really all you can do. You can't control other people. It's the old saying of, I can lead a horse to water, but I can't make him drink.
Yeah,
But
sure.
It's the truth with, you know, other people that have problems, you know, with relationships or, you know, anything like that. You can't change that other person. You have to change. You can only really work on yourself. All right. You can try and help them, but ultimately each person has to do their part to create healing.
We have so much in common. I was in that earthquake. I wasn't giving birth at the time, but that was the Landers quake you were talking
Yes.
about. But yeah.
Yep. Yep.
I was living in Riverside at the time.
Okay. Yeah. So you were out there too, so you could feel it.
I was close to it. It was in the,
yeah.
It was out in the Coachella Valley, and
yeah.
It was the first one was just about maybe between 5:30 and 6 in the morning, and it
Yes.
bolted me out of bed, and I had a television that was on the table, and I thought it was going to hit the floor, and I'd never been in one that big before. And then just about the time we got settled down, they call the other one the Big Bear quake, but
Right.
it was an
Yeah.
aftershock. But it was,
Yeah.
and you don't know when they're happening, whether it was a little one close by or a very big one far away. And then
Yeah.
you turn on the TV if it works, and
Right.
all they're doing, for those of you that haven't been in an earthquake, when you turn the TV on, the people in the studio are saying the lights were just moving back and forth. They don't have any information. They can't tell you much for probably about half an hour before you begin to really learn very much.
Right. And they're probably, you know, all in LA, so they're further away.
Yeah.
But I know that the kitchen lamp were swinging where we were in Huntington Beach. My parents told us they had, well, you know, they had woken up.
And then
So.
people are afraid to go under a roof. I had to, I was in a pastor of a church in Riverside, and people didn't want to go inside. We had mass on the lawn because people didn't know. There were rumblings every half hour or so, and nobody really wanted to be inside a building. They wanted to make sure there
Yes.
wasn't anything over their head. Yeah,
Yeah,
crazy.
because then they don't know if there's going to be another quake that's bigger, right,
Yeah,
than that first
exactly.
one, right? And so everybody's on their toes. And I was like on the seventh floor in that hospital.
Yeah,
Oh,
exactly.
it was awful, absolutely awful.
Well,
But all that of those aftershocks, and the hospital was built on rollers, so it was just rolling.
yeah. Well, thanks be to God for that.
Yeah.
Well, tell my audience how they can be in touch with you if they want to, or do you have any ways in which you like to receive feedback from people or queries?
Yeah, if they just go to my website, it's www.drlotte.com. You can sign up for my newsletter, and that's probably the best way to stay in touch, and I do offer classes. I teach about ancestral healing all the time. Also teach for the Theosophical Society about ancestral healing to help people create healing in their life. So, you know, that's the best way to stay up to date is to go there. And then, you know, you can look at all the different sessions I offer: ancestral healing, medical intuitive, connecting with your spirit guides, etc., mediumship readings.
What about IONS? Are you going to be at the convention in Phoenix in the summer?
Yes. You know, I mean, there's still, I haven't gotten the yes yet, but I did submit my proposal.
Okay,
I've spoken. Yeah, I've been part of the IONS convention twice before. Last year, I couldn't because I couldn't go to the East Coast at that time. But this year, it's right here in Phoenix.
Yeah, and for my audience, IANDS, IANDS, International Association for Near-Death Studies, it's a membership organization, but the annual conference is open to the public. You get a little bit of a discount if you're a member because you pay dues, but it's open to the public. And if this conversation makes you more interested in being with people that are have had experiences and are conversant, and people like you who have some academic chops where they can take their education and use that to try to understand experiences that seem so strange. The IONS convention would be just for you. I love being there because no story is too strange, and people are very respectful of each other's cosmologies and points of view. Well, it's been delightful having you on the show. I'm so grateful that you came.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And yes, hopefully we'll see many of the listeners at IONS. It's a fantastic conference.
Yeah. All right. God bless you. Well, thank you for being with me today on this episode of The Joyful Friar. Remember that if you can talk to today's guest through her website, and the same with me. If there's something that you think I might be able to do for you, you can contact me through nathan-castle.com. Remember that I'm always praying for you, and I'm grateful for your interest in our podcast. Bye now.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Joyful Friar. Please like, follow, and subscribe. You can visit me at nathan-castle.com. Send me a message by clicking the contact button. God bless.